I really appreciated what Marcus had to say. One thing that he said was he encourages people to read the Martyr's Mirror. And I think, too, we should be reading the various books that tell us about our beginnings. I've had an opportunity in several Beachy Preachers meetings to encourage them to read Menno's Complete Works. And I think I got at least two convinced to do it. And I know one did it. One finished it. And it's really something that we all ought to be doing, getting a feel for what happened. Now, sometimes I've talked to people who think, oh my, they think if only our beginnings hadn't been this way. They often don't know what our beginnings really were. And so it's good to read things like Martyr's Mirror, the complete works of Menno Simons. And if you either know German, the Ausbund, which is the oldest used hymnal in the world. And if you don't read German, there the New Order Amish are putting out a English translation of the various songs, and you can, I think only one volume is out. Is that right, Stephen? Okay. But I think another one is in process. And so if you don't know German, you can still read these good hymns about the martyrdom that our people experienced in those first 100 years. And to me, it's I can read German relatively well, and so I sometimes just like to read those songs and see what they were trying to tell the people of their time. If you want to, you can turn to page 9 in the handout. I have a little place there for you to make some notes if you wish to. One other thing that I appreciated about what Marcus said is that we can either withdraw when we are pressed, and that pressure often comes during wartime. We can either withdraw or we can reflect Christ's love. And you know, that is actually what non-resistance is. A little bit of this will come out in what I have to say, but non-resistance is not passivity. We are not called to be passive. Non-resistance is, as Marcus said, reflecting Christ's love, or sometimes I say it's the way Christians fight. We're the soldiers of Christ, and we're called to fight. Well, how do we fight? We fight differently than the world does. We fight and by love. We are not fighting people, we fight evil. And so non-resistance is not passivity, although sometimes our own people reject it, I think, because that's what they think it is. And it's actually the call to arms that we have as Christians, not the arms of this flesh, but it's the spiritual weapons that we have. And I think the best word is love, which is what you had said. Well, I'm going to be talking a little bit about the Mennonite experience, and when I say that, I mean Mennonite and Amish Mennonite together. So I'm not focusing on Mennonites as to the exclusion of Amish. It's Mennonite and Amish Mennonite, both. But I'm going to be looking at the Mennonite experience in America in the 18th and 19th centuries. If you consider 1683 as the date when the Mennonites began to come to this country to get organized as a Mennonite congregation, then that's 217 years. There were actually Mennonites in the New World before that, so it's a little bit more than 217 years, and I want to look a little bit at the history before we came here to get a little feel for what happened in the New World. Why is it important to look at history? There is one reason that it's important is it gives us perspective. If you just look at things today and don't know why they are that way, it can be pretty confusing. But if you have a little bit of an understanding of the history of things, it gives you some perspective. Also, it might be encouraging to think about this. I recently said something about my conversion experience and then how I joined the Beachy Church and all that. My background is Catholic, and what struck me was when I was experiencing all this, when I was experiencing the call of God and then conversion and then the decision to serve him, first I thought I would serve him as a Catholic priest, and then that didn't work out. And all of that seemed very confusing at the time, and it seemed like I was going through all these twists and turns. And it seemed like, why didn't this work out? You know, particular things. I was at a seminary for a while, and then I left because of I was disappointed at some of the teaching. And that seemed to me such a hard thing, because that was my path. To serve God, I was going to be a Catholic priest, and all of a sudden that wasn't there anymore. Well, that's the way it seemed at the time. Lots of turns, lots of twists, very confusing. Now when I look back, I see God at work. It's almost like a straight line now. And now the thing about history is you get the feeling it's all straight line. That's because we're looking at it from here. We're looking at all that stuff. But really, when you're experiencing it, the people who experienced it, it was as confusing for them as my life was for me, or is for me, at the very time. You don't know what God's doing all the time. Later on, you can see better. You can see that's why it happened. Just to give you one example. I had a vocations director when I thought I wanted to become a Catholic priest. He was a priest, and he decided that I was too conservative. Now, he didn't tell me this. I found this out later. And so he directed me to a liberal seminary. Well, that's why I quit. Because I couldn't take the kind of doctrine they were giving there. And at the time, it was very disconcerting, it was very discouraging, and it seemed like this weird turn in the road. Now it looks more like a straight shot. You know, if since that happened, I left. Now that's how I would see that anyway. But, so one thing is to give us some perspective. When you have over 200 years to look at, you can't really give a whole lot of detail. So what I decided to do was to look at some snapshots, I guess I'll call them, to try to understand why we are here. How did we get here? And so what I'm going to, and I looked for pictures that I'm going to try and give a verbal snapshot. I also have a couple of pictures I'll show on the overhead, and they don't quite fit everything that I'm saying, but they'll give a general idea. And so for the first thing, I would like to look at baptism and martyrdom. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what happened to Michael Sattler. And the picture I have is of a martyrdom. It comes out of Martyr's Mirror, but it's not Michael Sattler. But one reason I chose it was, at the end, Michael Sattler was tied to a ladder and thrown into the fire. And so there's a little similarity here in the picture. But anyway. On May 20th or 21st of 1527, that was about 2.5 years after the Anabaptist movement had gotten started, a former monk by the name of Michael Sattler was condemned for grave crimes against the Holy Roman Empire. Among other things, he was accused of disobeying the ancient enactments against rebaptizing and of refusing to swear an oath of loyalty. By doing this, he was undermining the law of the land. He was also accused of disbelieving Christian doctrines such as transubstantiation and infant baptism, and of leaving the monastery and of marrying. Thus, he undermined the established foundations of the church. He was also accused of treason because he taught that it's wrong to fight against the Turks. Now, at this time, the Turks were very much like the communist threat would have been seen in the 1950s up to the 1980s. And so Europeans saw it as necessary to fight the Turks, or else we're all going to be under bondage and forced to leave Christianity. And yet, Michael Sattler said it's wrong to do that, and if it were right to fight, indeed, he would rather fight with the Turks, because at least the Turk fights as someone who doesn't know what Christ teaches, and Christ would teach us not to fight. And so And that was, of course, seen as a very negative thing. Not only wouldn't he fight the Turks, but if he were going to fight, you know, he said, I'd rather fight on their side, because at least they're doing what they know, physically or humanly speaking, whereas we Christians ought to know better than that. Well, I can hardly imagine a worse case to bring against someone in the 16th century. You were undermining the two key foundations of all of society, the state and the church, by the things that he was doing. At least that's what it seemed to the people at the time. on the day that we mentioned, Michael Sattler's tongue, he was brought out into the square. His tongue was cut out, and the reason for that was to keep him from witnessing or testifying to his faith. They didn't do a very good job on that. He did pray and he did testify, and he could be understood. He was torn twice with red-hot tongs, and then he was chained to a wagon, taken out of town, taken down near a river where they had made a fire, and they built the bonfire, set it alight, and then tied him to a ladder, somewhat like this, and cast him into the fire. It's said that he had told his people that there would be a sign if he was remaining steadfast. And indeed, when the ropes burned off, he lifted his hand to indicate that he was staying faithful to the one that he had given his life to. Well, what caused this violent reaction to this man? And why was he willing to give his life the way he did? 10 years before, Martin Luther had shaken Europe with new ideas, a new way of teaching, a new way of thinking about what the church should be like. For various reasons, Europe was, and we can't get into these right now because it takes a long time to talk about them, but for various reasons, Europe was ready to hear something different. And so over these 10 years of time, Europe had gotten into a ferment about what should we believe, what is right, who does God favor or give his grace to. And so there was all this emotional and religious fervor going on, and it was seen as endangering, as I had mentioned earlier, the very foundations of society. And so whether you were satisfied with the way things were or if you thought they should be different, in either case, there was going to be a clash. And this ferment rocked Europe for about 130 years. The Reformation lasts about that long. And so this is just a little snapshot of the beginning. And of course, I think you can get the feeling from what Marcus said, that if most of the Anabaptist martyrs were killed in those first 10 years, that's really when a lot of this, the excitement and the tension and the ferment was at its height, in those first 10, maybe 20 years. And then gradually it became less that way. On the one side of this equation, you had a relatively successful society and a stable society. For about 1,500 years, people had been working towards bringing together the church and the state. And they had come to a rather successful union of the two. Everything in society was, I don't know if I want to use the word dictated, but shaped, at least, by the church. And so it sounds to me a lot like what some people today ask for when they want Christians to get involved in politics and take over the state and make it in our image. I think it's already happened once in our history, in the history of the church, and we see the results in the end of those results at the beginning of the Reformation. The people were no longer satisfied with all those solutions and answers. It didn't quite make sense anymore. Anyway, that's on one side. There were all these factors that had been drawn together and united Europe into a whole. But there were also some things that were trying to unravel this unity. The Renaissance had elevated the individual to a very high position. Turkey was a Muslim country that was trying to take Europe over, and so that threatened the cultural and religious existence of Europe. On the positive side, Europe was expanding overseas. This is the time of exploration. Europeans were going to India, Africa, the New World, and they were discovering all kinds of new things. And so that was sort of a very positive aspect. People said, wow, there's a lot more to the world than we knew about. Also, the older system of running Europe was called the feudal system, and that was beginning to break down. That was a system of loyalties among people and countries even, and that was all beginning to break down. But there is one thing that happened during this time that was very important. While there was a lot of unrest, there was a lot of the situation in Europe was not real settled at this time. But one of the issues that fed into the Reformation was the rediscovery, we might say, of the Bible in the original language. The rediscovery of the Greek New Testament. With that, people started looking at the way they lived church and asking, is that the same thing as what I see when I read the New Testament? And at least some of the people were saying, no, it isn't. There's quite a difference here. And that's one of the things that really fed into the ferment and the struggle with how should we live as a church. Whenever there's a time like this where there's a lot of ferment and when there's a lot of change from what the way things had been, let's face it, Europe was, although not completely united, things were mostly done in a certain way before the Reformation. Whenever something like that starts to change, there can be a lot of disagreement about which direction should we go in. And there was indeed, during the Reformation, Luther and Zwingli, two of the early leaders of the Reformation, couldn't agree with each other. And so Protestantism, as such, did not unite into one group, but split into several different groups. There was another group, who became known as the Anabaptists, who unfortunately for them were not only do we see things a bit differently than Luther and Zwingli, but also the Catholics. So in essence, we sort of had everyone sort of down on us. Now, some of that we ended up earning by some of our actions, but needless to say, I just want to say that we found ourselves in a situation where we really didn't have any allies in that. But anyway, this is the setting. We came out of a very unsettled period of time, where what had been the established way of looking at things was changing. And there was people were looking at the Bible, they were looking at the New Testament, but there wasn't an agreed way of understanding that. And so the change that came out of this went several different directions. Some, like the Anabaptists, perhaps tried to get closer to what the New Testament had to say, and were very definitely influenced on some ideas such as non-resistance, in a way that some of the other groups were not. Okay, I liked the eras that Marcus came up with. And the second snapshot that I would like to look at is the Treaty of Westphalia. And this was signed in the city of Munster. Now Munster, there's a little irony here. Munster is the place. This is a picture of Munster, a sketch of Munster during the Anabaptist Rebellion in Munster. There were Anabaptists who took over this city. This is one of the few instances where Anabaptists actually resorted to violence. And they took the city over and they withstood a siege by Catholic and Lutheran troops for a little over a year. So there's a little irony here that the next important place, the next little snapshot I want to look at, is it takes place in the city of Munster. And it is the signing of the Treaty of Westphalia. And the important thing about this is, this occurred in October 24, 1648. And it's the ending of the 30 Years' War that Marcus said something about. It's important because it's basically the end of the Reformation. It's the last war in Europe that was fought specifically for religious reasons. And it had a huge impact on us for several reasons. There wasn't just one treaty. There's the treaty that's being signed here is being signed in Munster, and it's a treaty between France and the Holy Roman Empire, or what we would call today Germany. And they're swearing that they will uphold these are all the men that signed the treaty, and they're swearing that they will uphold the different points of the treaty. Human nature hasn't changed. It's rather intriguing. The Catholic delegates met in Munster. The Protestant delegates met in a city about 80 miles away called Osnabrück. And so they couldn't get along well enough to even meet in the same city. So I suppose they had to have couriers going back and forth to say, what are we going to, you know, what do we agree to? But anyway, this particular treaty was signed between France and Germany. And one of the important things about this is that it brought peace and in the religious area. Basically, after this, toleration starts to grow in Europe. One of the other treaties that was part of this whole process of finishing up the 30 Years' War was a treaty between Spain and the Netherlands. Well, of course, we know that the Netherlands has a large number of Mennonites in it. And one of the things that was important there is, even before the treaty between Spain and the Netherlands, Mennonites had been tolerated in Holland already, or in the Netherlands. And so now, with the treaty between Spain, which had originally claimed the Netherlands as one of its provinces, and the Netherlands is now recognized as an independent country, and it begins to develop on its own. It becomes very prosperous. And we, Mennonites there, who have already received toleration, benefit from this. We become not just tolerated, but we become prosperous. And that'll have several important impacts on us. Another thing that's important from this time is that this 30 Years' War was a very, very vicious war. And as Marcus mentioned, the armies would go back and forth over the same territory. We don't know for sure, but about a third of the population of Germany was killed during this war. Some areas, a larger percentage was killed, and in other areas, a smaller percentage of the people were killed. But overall, about a third of the Germans lost their lives during this time. And in those areas where the armies went back and forth, and as Marcus mentioned, one of those was the southern Rhine Valley, what had been a blooming, prosperous civilization was a wilderness, a man-made wilderness. And with very few people. Often whole villages would be completely deserted. Well, now that the treaties are being signed and everybody is sort of agreeing we're going to tolerate each other, those particular rulers in those areas where the people were missing started looking around for replacements. And one of the areas that replacements came from were Switzerland, where the Anabaptists were still being persecuted, not by martyrdom. They were not being executed, but they were being harassed and sometimes sent off to be galley slaves and things like that. So there was a lot of pressure still being put on the Anabaptists in Switzerland. And I would say that's sort of an exception to Europe at this time after the end of the 30 Years' War. But anyway, so people began to leave Switzerland. Anabaptists began to leave Switzerland, go up the Rhine Valley to settle in these areas where the rulers needed people. They were desperate, and so they began to open up their lands to be settled by Mennonites from Switzerland. And they gave them toleration. They said, you can worship here, but they also put restrictions on them. you can't evangelize. You cannot try and win someone from the state church to your church. You can't have meetings of more than, I think usually it was 20 families. So if a meeting got to be bigger than that, it would have to somehow disperse or change. But anyway, so we find ourselves after the end of the 30 Years' War in a situation where, whereas we may not have complete freedom, at least in most of Europe, we're tolerated, and in some places we're even appreciated because there's nobody else there, and the ruler needs to have some people to rule and people to farm and make the country productive again. And so Anabaptists, because of that, begin to move up into the Rhine Valley, and their lives change there. They begin to appreciate the added freedom they have. They're not really totally free, what we would consider free, but at least it's not like the harassment that they received in Switzerland. Well, a few years after our people begin to move up in the Rhine Valley, I think it's about 40 years later, something new starts to happen there. William Penn and George Fox begin to do journeys through the Rhine Valley and other parts of Germany, preaching their Quaker message, this new understanding of how to approach God. There are a certain number of similarities between what the Quakers teach and what we teach. One main one would be the understanding of non-resistance. And we don't have to discuss whether it's all the same or not, but at least both groups would have seen the role of the Christian in this world in a somewhat similar way. And so George Fox and William Penn began several journeys in this area, and they were usually rather well received by the Mennonites in these areas. And in fact, many Mennonites converted and became Quaker during this time. Well, a few years later, William Penn received a grant of land in this new world that's called Pennsylvania, and he was given that because the king had owed his father a debt, and so his father being gone, the king paid his debt off to William Penn by giving him this territory. And one of the things that after that happened, that was in 1681. After that happened, one of the things that that William Penn would also talk about when he was going through Germany was he began to invite people, come to my land in Europe, the New World, which will be called Pennsylvania, and settle there. And he promised them religious freedom and political freedom. And this was unheard of. But it appealed to the Quakers who were there, and it appealed to some of the Mennonites. It appealed increasingly to the Mennonites over time. And in 1683, the first boatload of Germans came over to settle in Pennsylvania. They came over on a ship called the Concord. Probably most of them were Quakers. One family was distinctively Mennonite, would have called itself Mennonite. And so this is more or less the beginning of the Mennonite presence, at least in an organized way, in the New World in 1683. Now, just a few years before this, the Netherlands had controlled the area of New York, New Jersey, and Delaware, and there were Mennonites from Holland in that area. But it doesn't look like they ever had an organized congregational life. And so as far as the beginnings of an organized congregational life that really had some potential to continue, we'll point to that date of 1683 as the beginning of that. There were Mennonites before that, and actually some of those Dutch Mennonites eventually became part of the experience of Mennonites in Pennsylvania. But the real beginning, I think you could say, goes to that invitation of William Penn, come to my territory in the New World where you can have freedom, political and political, economic, and religious. And one of the big draws was talked about in along the Rhine Valley. These Mennonites were appreciated for the farming skills they had and for the hard work they would do, but they couldn't own the land. And so, and they were taxed rather heavily. And so here all of a sudden was the potential to have something they had never had before, their own piece of land, and work for themselves. They were working for themselves, but of course they couldn't pass it on. So there's a little difference there. I think all of us would agree with that. As the Mennonites began to move out of the Rhine Valley and come to Pennsylvania, more replaced them from Switzerland because there was still persecution there. And so as one group would feel that, you know, it's interesting, whatever we get used to, when we get used to something, it doesn't feel quite as good as it did. So when those Swiss exiles landed in the Alsace or in the Palatinate right along the Rhine Valley, that really felt good. We're not being persecuted anymore. But after you've been there a while and you have to pay heavy taxes and you can't own your land and they keep telling you you can't have meetings bigger than 20 families, all those things, after a while, something else might sound a whole lot more appealing. And so those people left. Well, they were replaced with people who were being persecuted in Switzerland, to whom this old situation really still looked very good. And so you kind of have this situation where one group, after they get a little bit tired of the restrictions, kind of move on, and another group comes and replaces them because they find this real freedom. And then later on, some of them continue the whole process and move on again. One other factor that was important about this treaty at the end of the 30 Years' War was the fact that Holland, or the Netherlands, became free, and it became prosperous, and so did we. The Dutch Mennonites became very, very prosperous. And they were able to do two things that were helpful for getting Mennonites here to the United States, or to America at the time. It wasn't the United States. One thing was they would intercede with their own government, with the Dutch government, and ask the Dutch government to intercede for Mennonites in Switzerland and see if you can do something about the persecution. And so we actually had something we never had before. We had a power. We had a hand on a lever of power. And that was a new thing. The Dutch Mennonites had that. They could actually talk to their government, and their government would listen and would help out. And so the Dutch embassy in Switzerland would request, please don't persecute these people. Do other things. Let them leave, but don't persecute them. And the other reason that this treaty at the end of the 30 Years' War was very important because of what happened in the Netherlands was that these people now were prosperous, and they still recognized that we have a responsibility to our brothers who aren't as prosperous and who aren't in the situation of freedom that we are. And so they were very helpful in moving the Anabaptists from the Rhine Valley who wanted to move to the New World. Now, they did try to discourage them because, after all, this is their money they're putting out. And they did try to tell them, you know, you don't know what's going to happen in the New World. But they did help the people when they came. When people left and showed up in Holland and didn't have money, they were often helped by the Dutch. Then later on, after there were American Mennonites established, often they would do the same thing. They would often redeem Mennonites who had come over on a ship and more or less sold themselves to the captain. And then what the captain would do when they arrived in the New World, he would sell that person, not as a slave, but as a servant for, let's say, 7 years. And you would go and buy those people. And Mennonites would often do that, go and purchase the service, not the body, but the service of that person who could not have afforded to come here otherwise. So that was also a way of sort of mutual aid. And so either the Dutch Mennonites or later on the American Mennonites often helped their brothers who were poor come to the New World. Well, the next snapshot is Germantown. This is the first place in the New World that the Anabaptists were able to establish themselves as a congregation. And the irony is, I read this the other day, that this is not only the first congregation, but it's also the first and only city congregation for 200 years. So the first congregation in the New World was in a town or a little city, and we don't do that again really until about 200 years later. Then we start having some more urban congregations. So most of the congregations after this are out in the countryside. I just came across that the other day. I'd never given it a thought. I thought it was kind of interesting. But anyway, one of the interesting things about this is when they first got here, when the Anabaptists or the Mennonites first got here, there weren't a whole lot of us. And so at first, probably the first 10, maybe not quite 10 years, we actually worshiped together with other people because none of us really had enough people to form our own congregation. But then after about 7 to 10 years, probably in part because of differences in opinions, the Mennonites began to get together on their own and worship together. In 1699, they chose a minister, William Rittenhouse, as their first preacher. Now, they had been meeting for several years before this, but they didn't have anyone who was actually a preacher, and so one of their members would actually read written sermons that had been put together in book form in Europe. So that would have been, that would have been their services at the first, basically reading sermons from someone else that had given them in Europe. But by 1699, at least, they had their first preacher, William Rittenhouse, and probably about 1708, they both built the first building. It wasn't this building, it was a log building in Germantown. And they also chose their first bishop. They had their first baptisms, and they had communion for the first time in 1708. So 1708 was a pretty important time. It's when the church was basically established in a way that it would keep on going. And also by that time, Mennonites were spreading out, and so there were other congregations starting, more or less in the countryside. Why did these people come to the New World? Well, there were some things that drew them. That land was a big thing. The ability to be your own boss, to have a piece of land that you control, that was a big thing, and it wasn't something that was possible in Europe. Another thing was family connections. A lot of people would be drawn because somebody else from their family had gone, and they'd hear back what happened to him. Usually a pretty good report. And so family connections drew. Another thing was that guarantee of religious freedom. That also was completely unusual. Although the Mennonites were being tolerated in a lot of the areas they lived in Europe, there was no guarantee that would continue. If you lived under a ruler and he died and his son came on the scene as the new ruler, perhaps he would feel that his father had been too lenient. And so everything depended on the whim and the will of that ruler, how you would be treated. So here was a situation where we had religious freedom guaranteed. There were also some things that pushed us, caused us to leave, and I would suggest that probably one of the bigger things was the treatment that our people were still receiving in Switzerland. That was a big incentive to going elsewhere. I don't have a booklet up here. What time am I supposed to quit? Am I seeing that right? Is it 11? 5 till, okay. We're gonna go really fast. The next snapshot is, let me see here. The next one is called Like Fish in the Water. And we found ourselves all of a sudden in a totally different environment where in Europe, there was always that possibility of conflict, and there was always a little bit of tension, and you just didn't know how you would get along with your next-door neighbor because of religious differences. And now we find ourselves in a situation where instead of all these possible things causing problems between us, you found yourself next to people who spoke the same language, and German, and who... While they might not have the same name as you, you might be a Mennonite, and they might be Reformed, or they might be Lutheran, or they might even, there were some Catholics there too. Well, you seem to see the things that were similar. And so often they began to worship together. And this church is what's called a union church. And this was extremely common in Pennsylvania at this time. There are not enough of us Lutherans here, and there are not enough of us Mennonites here to really build our own little congregation. So what they did, our church house or meeting house, so what they did was they would build a church together, and they would worship together, usually on different Sundays. Well, when I say together, they'd worship one Sunday, the Mennonites would meet, the next Sunday, the Reformed would meet. Okay, and you could go to the other services. It wasn't that you... were not allowed to, but they didn't meet together in the sense that this Sunday the Mennonite preacher is going to preach, the next Sunday the Reformed. They would meet on different Sundays, but they worked together. And then as time went on and the congregations grew, they would tend to separate, and you'd have a church that was a Reformed church and a church that was a Mennonite church. But interestingly enough, in some of the deeds, at least to the Mennonite churches, they would specify that the church has to be open for use for funerals of those other than our own faith, for those other than Mennonites. So even after each group would start to establish its own church or church house, they would still want to recognize that, well, maybe there's another group here. They're not quite big enough to have a church. And if somebody dies there, or if we have a bigger church house, we want them to have freedom to have their funeral here. Everyone can come together. So the interesting thing was, church life was so different than it was in Europe. Over in Europe, it was the divisions that mattered. Over here, we started seeing things how we're similar. All of us had sort of a pietistic approach to our Christian life, whether you were Reformed, Lutheran, or Anabaptist. And so there were some things, at least, that we could see made us alike. And those things seemed to be key factors at this time. And there's a whole lot more we could talk about, but I have to quit. But we also at the same time recognized that we did have very unique aspects to our belief, one of them being non-resistance. And we maintained an awareness that our approach to Christianity is different, but we also had an awareness now that there wasn't persecution and strife because of religion, that there are a lot of things that are connecting us. And that phrase, there's one thing I meant to read, but I'm kind of running out of time. There is a phrase, the phrase comes from, like fish in water, comes from a letter by a Schwenkfelder bishop to some friends in Europe. And he wrote the letter in 1768. And here's part of what he said. You can hardly imagine how many denominations you will find here when you attend a big gathering, for instance, a funeral. We are always at peace with each other. That was something hard to believe. Everybody speaks his mind freely. That was also hard to believe, because in Europe, if you spoke your mind freely, at least if you were this or that and it was the wrong place, you could get yourself in trouble. We are all going to and fro like fish in water. There were things that made us feel at ease with each other. And so this was a completely different experience. Just quickly, I just want to say that the next things that I would want to talk about are the French and Indian War, which is the first time that we, in the New World, that we found out that some of our beliefs can cause a real problem. We and the Quakers, and some other groups too, in Pennsylvania, wanted to seek to live at peace with the Indians, and were not willing to participate in militia training, which the British were asking all the colonies to do. And so this is the first time that we have a clash here. We've been living in Pennsylvania for about 50 years or 60 years, and all of a sudden, there's a big problem. And it's because of, as Marcus said, these wars are really important. The world uses wars for its own reasons, and when you aren't willing to cooperate, problems happen. Now, I can't talk about the whole thing, but that was important for us, but not as important as the Revolutionary War. By the time of the Revolutionary War, we had become very comfortable with the situation we were in. We were voting. We were participating in the government, not as office holders so much, but as those who would vote in order to keep those like us, the Quakers, in power. And that caused some stress in the church, and I can't get into that right now because I got to quit. But one of the important things that happened out of this war, as the patriots, the revolutionaries, got power in each of the colonies, they began to put pressure on everyone, all the men, to be part of this movement. Hey, we want to protect our freedom. The irony is, we were so appreciative of the British because of the freedom they gave us. And we look at these rebels and say, you know, really? This is freedom? They were putting pressure on us, the British weren't. And so there's quite a contradiction or a paradox in what we were experiencing there. But probably the most important thing that came out of this was that we began to recognize that there really, even in this situation where we all can work together so wonderfully well, that there were some really important differences in what we believed and what that meant for our life. And I agree with what Marcus said. I think the key issue is, how do we live as church? And that's both important in how we live with each other, but then it's also important in how we live with those who are different than us. And at least one aspect of that, as I said, is that we live non-resistantly. We live a way of love. That's how we fight. If we're going to disagree, we are supposed to do it out of love. We don't always succeed in that, but that's what's supposed to be happening. And so I went over time, so sorry, and didn't quite get everything said that I would like to, but I think you can get kind of a feel. The experience in America was a freeing experience, but it also showed us some real tensions. How do we challenge? Let me look at my little, I had a phrase down here that I wanted to say. How do we challenge the world and say, you know, we think that Christ is saying this? How do we challenge the world, but how do we engage it? We had come to a place where it was easy to engage and get tied up because there was so much freedom here. Now, all of a sudden, we're finding out it's not all that easy. Every now and then, something happens, like a war, and we have to learn how to both engage and to challenge and say, we don't agree with that. And it was a very difficult lesson, and it comes mostly because of those wars that you'll see on the outline that I had. Thanks for your attention.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.